Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The day after his Oval Office address to the nation about Iraq, President Bush faced more questions about a secret domestic surveillance program during a year-end news conference at the White House this morning. The president brushed aside criticism of the program and said it will continue as long as the nation faces the threat of an enemy that, as he said, wants to kill American citizens. Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine, was at the news conference. Hello, Richard.
Hi, great to be with you.
The president lashed out at the Senate today over its failure to reauthorize the Patriot Act. Let's listen to an excerpt.
It is inexcusable for the United States Senate to let this Patriot Act expire. You know, there's an interesting debate in Washington, and you're part of it, that says, well, they didn't connect the dots prior to September the 11th. They being not only my administration, but previous administrations. Now, I understand that debate. I'm not being critical of you bringing this issue up and discussing it, but there was you might remember, if you take a step back, people were pretty adamant about hauling people up to testify and wondering how come the dots weren't connected. Well, the Patriot Act helps us connect the dots.
Well, Richard, do you think the president made a compelling case today for the Patriot Act, especially amid this story about the domestic surveillance program?
Well, he made a compelling case that, first of all, he feels very passionately about this and that he's prepared to use this politically. I mean, there was a very thinly veiled threat there to people who oppose him, and it's not just Democrats. There are some Republicans in the Senate who have been blocking the renewal of part of the Patriot Act. And the threat was that, you know, if they want to fight him on this one, he will take it to the people and the country and basically accuse them of having weakened America and America's defenses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of passion there, and he has a political card there that he's willing to play, which is pretty strong.
Much of the news conference was about the domestic surveillance program, and the president said the program's been very successful in protecting American citizens. Do you think he made a case for that program as well?
Well, actually, I think there are probably more holes in his defense there on that provision, on the whole eavesdropping issue. And the holes were, and he spent, one way you know those holes are is because he spent so much of his press conference trying to justify this policy. The holes are this. First of all, there's plenty of provision there for the president or his aides to go to something that he called FISA, which is a Washington acronym, a Foreign Intelligence Court, a very secret court, and to get the authorization he needs to do this kind of eavesdropping anyway. Secondly, he spent a lot of time since 9/11 introducing various pieces of legislation that could have dealt with any loophole there was. And thirdly, his basic position was that if the terrorists or terrorist suspects know that we are eavesdropping, then they'll figure something out and change their methods. In fact, as he pointed out, they have long known that American officials are eavesdropping or are likely to eavesdrop on their communications. And so this idea that national security is somehow undermined because there was no warrant or court order, it seems to me pretty irrelevant. Basically, the president has all the power he needs. Intelligence officials, law enforcement officials can do what they like anyway.
He also blasted whoever leaked this about the surveillance program to the media, and he sort of put the ball back in Congress's court. He said Congress has been kept up to date. He said he's met with Congress members of Congress more than 12 times about this program.
He said that they had been briefed a dozen times. There is a serious dispute here about this. The people who have supposed to have been briefed about this, people sitting on the intelligence committees in Congress, say either they were briefed and suggest, anyway, that they voiced strong opposition to it, or they say they were briefed and no mention was made of this. So, you know, in many ways, members of Congress are more limited in what they can say about this than the president because all of this is classified material.
Mm-hmm. Any news here today from this press conference? What do you take from this, Richard?
Well, obviously, the two things that we always look for, the unscripted moments, and I think the passion that he has, the anger even that he has about these two cases, about the eavesdropping and the Patriot Act, were remarkable. As for news itself, I wouldn't say so. I mean, you know, there's always a back and forth. He had some interesting insights, for instance, into his position on Iran, most especially that he basically conceded the intelligence failures about Iraq have made it much, much harder for him to make the case to the world about Iran's nuclear weapons. I think that was noteworthy. Whether it's newsworthy, that's an editor's decision.
Right, right. All right. Well, Richard, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Richard Wolff is political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. President Bush's press conference came just hours after the House of Representatives passed a massive defense spending bill. The sweeping measure includes pay raises for soldiers, and it opens the way for oil drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. The House worked into the early hours of this morning trying to finish up its work for the year, and there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about what exactly has passed. Among the items the House and Senate have been wrangling over is legislation that would protect vaccine makers from lawsuits. Supporters say the bill is necessary to protect the nation from pandemics such as avian flu because it will encourage drug companies to produce vaccines without fear of legal repercussions. Critics say that the legislation will put people at risk by denying them their right to sue companies if they feel that they've been harmed by new vaccines. Well, to talk about this issue, we're joined by Christopher Milne. He's assistant director of the Center for the Study of Drug Development at Tufts University, and he's here with us in studio. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Deborah.
Also with us is Barbara Lowe Fisher. She's president of the National Vaccine Information Center, a consumer watchdog group that's based in Vienna, Virginia. And she's joining us on the line from her home. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
Chris, let's start with you. What's the basic idea behind this legislation?
Well, the legislation has many features. And basically what they're trying to do is encourage or incentivize drug companies and biotech companies to get into the business and stay in the business of producing vaccines as well as other countermeasures for both bioterror as well as pandemic threats to this country and to the world.
So we're not just talking about bird flu. Here.
No, we're talking about a whole host of diseases, everything from SARS to any number of potential health threats to the country that some of which have been around for many years, some of which we don't even know about yet.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, tell us, what do you think in general of the idea of giving liability protection to drug companies?
I think it's a bad idea. You know, the companies were afforded quite a bit of liability protection under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, which I and other parents worked with Congress to create and pass in the mid-80s. There were four vaccine manufacturers at the time. The act has done a very good job in protecting the companies because there are eight manufacturers today, more than twice as many as there were back then, that are now producing vaccines for our country. We have around 10 lawsuits pending in the court systems, most of them for the DPT vaccine, which is a vaccine we don't use anymore that caused many of the injuries and deaths of children about 20 years ago. So I think that we have legislation, or rather a law in place already that protects the companies, and I think that we need to be able to exercise a Seventh Amendment right to the Constitution, and that is to be able to have our day in court in front of a jury of our peers if we're injured or harmed for any reason. We should not be protecting one industry from being held accountable in the court system.
And Chris?
Well, this doesn't completely abrogate your right to go to court. This sets a high threshold. This particular bill, if in fact it's part of this package that went through, sets a particularly high threshold under certain circumstances, emergency circumstances declared by the Secretary of Health. So it's limited to particular countermeasures and under particular circumstances. The threshold is indeed high. I mean, they have to prove that they violated the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, as well that it was due to willful misconduct. And then they have to go on to the next arm, which would be to say that then caused a significant and unreasonable risk, and that risk was the proximate cause of the injury. And then they are going to define injury. So, yes, if in fact it goes through, it will set a fairly high standard for a plaintiff to prove their case. But I think that's the idea.
And I think that what is very concerning to those of us who for the past couple of decades have been watching legislation that's been passed at the state and federal level regarding vaccination is that this is going to widen the definition of a countermeasure. It is going to widen the definition of an emergency. It's not just going to be for bioterrorism, potential bioterrorism attacks, which was most of the legislation was focused on post 9/11. It widens it to natural disease outbreaks, not just pandemic flu, but natural disease outbreaks, which is a very wide category. And so the other thing that's concerning is the Secretary of Health does not have to justify to anyone that why the emergency is being declared. Once the emergency is declared, the governors at the state level, through legislation passed since 9/11, can use the state militia to arrest, quarantine, and forcibly vaccinate citizens. This is a very serious. If you cannot go to court, if you or your child or a loved one is injured by these experimental drugs and vaccines that are going to be developed in an agency that this legislation would create, which would be not subject to the FOIA oversight, and so citizens would not be able to know what is in the vaccines, what the injuries and deaths that have been associated with the vaccines look like. And I think that we simply have to have transparency, we have to have accountability, and we have to have justice with regard to our mass vaccination system in an emergency situation or an ordinary situation.
Chris, let's go to the crux of this. Our company is not making vaccines because of concerns about lawsuits.
It's not just that. There are a number of concerns. And again, there's some discussion about exactly what's been happening to the vaccine industry over the years. Some people point to statistics, and I can remember, in fact, having grown up in the industry more or less, that there were many more manufacturers back in the 60s and 70s. A couple of events happened in the 70s and 80s, one involving some federal court cases in which all of a sudden they decided that the learned intermediary defense was no longer viable, that you had to inform the actual patients themselves of the risks. So that made the drug companies get worried. And the second one was that all of a sudden they took some big hits as far as some losing some cases, which were multi-million dollar cases back in the 70s. And so drug companies, in fact, did get out of the business. There were 25 in the 60s and 70s. Now, just by our count in our databases, we have six majors that seem to be out there making vaccines. There are a number of smaller companies that are out there also in the vaccine business. But as far as major companies, we're down to about five or six.
Mm-hmm. No, we're down to eight. We've got Wyeth, Merck, Sanofi Pasteur, GlaxoSmithKline, MedImmune, Chiron, Bioport, and VaxGen. In the early 80s, we only had Wyeth, Lederle, Merck, and Connaught. So there have been mergers and acquisitions, as you know. But basically, we have a very rich market here because we have mandates. We have the most vaccines mandated in this country compared to the rest of the world. And so the manufacturers have a stable, ready-made market, particularly with regard to childhood vaccines. And no liability, very little liability since 1986. If you then cut off all liability with this legislation, you are going to be in a situation where vaccines can be forced to be used by citizens, and there will be no recourse, no judicial review. And I think that's unjust.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break. We're talking with Christopher Milne of the Center for the Study of Drug Development at Tufts University and Barbara Lowe Fisher of the National Vaccine Information Center. Our conversation is about liability protection for vaccine manufacturers. We'll be back after a short break. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about whether drug companies should be given liability protection to encourage them to produce vaccines. We're joined on the line by Barbara Lowe Fisher. She's president of the National Vaccine Information Center, which is a consumer watchdog group. Also in studio with us is Chris Milne. He's assistant director of the Center for the Study of Drug Development at Tufts University. Barbara, right before the break, you said that you feel that this is a Seventh Amendment issue, really, that you're taking away the rights of Americans to legal process. I'm wondering, do you object to liability protection in any case or this one specifically because it would be so general and sweeping?
Well, I think that you need to look at the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. What happened there was a federal compensation mechanism was created. However, there were there was access to the judicial system in three instances. First, if the child was turned down for federal compensation. Second, if the child was offered too little compensation to take care of the child's lifetime needs. And third, and very importantly, if the plaintiff, if the family could prove that the drug company engaged in criminal fraud or gross negligence, you could go into the court system. We need to be, that's what happened with the tobacco industry. We, as citizens, need to have access to the judicial system, which is a check and balance in our democracy on power of the executive branch or the legislative branch. We need to protect that right. And I think that to have sweeping liability protections, like in the language that is being inserted in the Department of Defense Appropriations Bill, that would totally remove liability from companies who could engage in criminal fraud and gross negligence in the manufacture of these experimental vaccines and drugs we could be forced to take, is simply not something we would want in our country.
Chris?
Well, again, you're dealing with extremely difficult circumstances for the manufacturers themselves. They would be happening under conditions of a pandemic, whether it's natural. And, of course, Mother Nature can be the worst bioterrorist, as some people have said. You would be dealing where you would be having to vaccinate thousands, millions of people in a short period of time. Many of them are healthy. In fact, under the animal efficacy rule, where some of these vaccines may, in fact, be approved without having actually experienced them or tried them out with regard to their safety concerns in a human population. And for obvious reasons, you're not going to manufacture an anthrax exposure situation just to test a vaccine. These are very much high-risk, high-vulnerability situations that would make any company nervous about getting into this sort of business. They're obviously going to be reprioritizing towards more safe and lucrative areas if you don't incentivize them.
So overall, the general public health threat really would trump here over individual concerns.
In my opinion, I think it does. And in this particular case, as we've done with other situations where there have been high needs with regard to orphan drugs, with regard to pediatric studies, we've given fairly high incentives, and I think that those programs have worked.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, are you concerned that without some sort of protection here, then the companies might not make vaccines like the one that might be required in case of a flu pandemic?
You know, some sort of protection is very different from blanket protection. And I think that you know, when it happens to you or your child or your loved one, when you're the one that the vaccine injures, or you have someone who dies from a vaccination, and you can and you are able to prove that there was criminal fraud or gross negligence involved, or there was some kind of dereliction of duty involved, you should be able to hold that company responsible in a court of law. I think that individual rights become very important, because when you devalue the individual, it, by extension, you ultimately devalue the whole. And I think we have to get away from talking about the public health versus individual health. Everybody is important, and we should do everything we can to ensure that our mass vaccination system is safe, and access to the judicial branch is one way to do that.
Do you see areas in the legislation, Chris, where there could be some exceptions made to sort of help balance this individual and public health concerns?
Yeah. Most of the legislation that I've seen, it, in fact, seems to me to be not enough and not soon enough. I worry when I see a bill like this, I have to think that this is probably the premier incentivizing feature, as opposed to the BioShield 2 Act, the Lieberman bill, where they had the market exclusivity, transferable market exclusivity, which was more of the incentive. This is probably, again, the kind of keystone of what might attract a company to stay in this field, to get in this field. Again, they are looking, even the small companies have to depend on venture capital. They're very finicky. Bunch that if they don't see the proper protections in place, they're liable again to put their money someplace else. So I think we have to do as much as we can to make sure that we have enough people that are producing, going into this high-risk field as it is.
Mm-hmm. And when do we get to the point, I think, or how do you feel? And Barbara, I'd like to hear from you first on this, about when people should be forced to take vaccines.
Well, I think we, you know, ethically, you have to adhere to the informed consent principle. That was the principle that was reinforced at the doctor's trial at Nuremberg, and the Helsinki Declarations, the Nuremberg Code, all reinforced the importance of the informed consent ethic. That is, if a medical procedure can injure or kill you, you should have the right to self-determination. You should have the right to have full information and make a voluntary decision. I think at all costs in the society, we have to defend the informed consent ethic. That's certainly something that I would think everyone would agree on.
Yeah, but can it work, actually, in a practical way?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, if you go back to in the 1950s, when the parents in this country were begging for a polio vaccine, the country was supporting it, the masses were supporting it. I think that when you start passing laws that force people against their will to use products that can injure or kill them, you don't have the faith of the people. This is why, the people are going to look at this legislation, and they're going to say there must be something really, really dangerous about these vaccines. If we have to give wholesale liability protection to the vaccine companies. And I think that you are going to see an erosion of the public trust when you pass this kind of legislation. You have to have the people behind you. You have to have the people willing to stand up and get the vaccines. And if they believe that it's being these vaccines are being created in secret, and everyone who either orders them or gives them or makes them is going to get off scot-free.
We're out of time, Barbara. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Barbara Lowe Fisher, she's president of the National Vaccine Information Center, a consumer watchdog group based in Virginia. Christopher Milne is assistant director of the Center for the Study of Drug Development at Tufts University. Thanks to both of you for being with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. On Capitol Hill, there's a bipartisan call to investigate the National Security Agency's domestic eavesdropping program. The program came to light after a New York Times article Friday revealed that the president gave the agency permission to monitor Americans' calls and emails without getting a court order. Today, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said that Congress gave the president the power to allow domestic spying when it authorized the use of force after 9/11. Joining us to talk about how this controversy is playing out across the country are Nolan Finley, editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Welcome, Nolan.
Hello, Deborah.
Also with us is Guy McMillan. He's editorial page editor for the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Welcome, Guy.
Thank you, Deb.
Nolan, first to you. The president today during his news conference defended the decision to authorize the National Security Agency to wiretap international communications originating in the U.S. What's been the reaction to this story, do you think?
Well, in terms of the public, I'm not sure this is an issue that really resonates with the public. It's a very complex issue, and I think, once again, people assume that as long as they're obeying the law, they're not going to get caught up in this, which is a very real dangerous attitude to assume, because as we've seen here, this administration does not have a whole lot of respect for the civil liberty protections.
Guy, I'm wondering, this comes amid the debate over the Patriot Act and Senate Democrats successfully filibustering renewal of the Patriot Act on Friday. So what do you think the political impact might be for the president?
Well, I should say that one of the senators who was filibustering is a Republican from New Hampshire, John Sununu, who's a conservative. So it's not entirely a Democratic effort. I think the president is a little bit on slippery ground here. If he's not going to obey the laws that require that he get judicial authority before he wiretaps and reads people's email and everything, I don't know why he needs the Patriot Act to be renewed, which is a law that allows certain liberties with our civil liberties.
I mean, exactly. You've already got a secret court that the president can go to, a court that the public doesn't know a whole lot about, a court where there's not extraordinary checks and balances built in. And he bypassed even that court to authorize these wiretaps himself. I think he owes, I mean, we do need an explanation. This administration owes the American people an explanation of how this was used, who it was used against, and they can't be allowed to hide behind this whole national security curtain this time. And the American people, you know, will cut him a great deal of slack if they think he's acting to protect them, because, you know, they want their security above all else. But there are some questions here about why he didn't use the processes that were already in place to give him extraordinary powers to bypass the Constitution. And quite frankly, some congressional leaders also have some questions to answer, because apparently many members of Congress were aware this was going on.
Right. Nolan, what do you plan to write about this story in the editorial pages of the Detroit News?
Well, we're working on that now, and I guess our point is going to be that the president, if the president is going to act outside the law, and there may be situations where the president has to take extraordinary action to protect the American people. But if he's going to do that, it has to be in a very isolated circumstance. And we can't be, he can't take this position that, yes, I've done it, I'm going to continue to do it, and, you know, what are you going to do about it?
And Guy, you have not written about the NSA story for the Keene Sentinel. Why not?
Well, you know, we put this on page 9 when it came out last Friday. It didn't strike us as a huge departure from the other initiatives of this administration.
And once again, he snatches defeat from the jaws of victory. He had a lot to brag about over the weekend. The election in Iraq was, again, a symbol of why we're in Iraq, and was a success the president could stand up and brag about. And yet, once again, it gets overwhelmed by the criticism of the way this administration carries out its business.
All right, let's talk about the president's speech that he made from the Oval Office last night. He did not talk about the spying story, but he did focus on the war in Iraq and what he called the road to victory.
Our men and women in uniform, who have done so much already, will continue their brave and urgent work. And tonight, I ask all of you listening to carefully consider the stakes of this war, to realize how far we have come and the good we are doing, and to have patience in this difficult, noble, and necessary cause.
Now, the president seemed to be gaining ground a bit last week in the polls, and he's been, this was really one of a series of speeches that he's been making about the war in Iraq. Do you think that he's making some ground ahead here, Guy?
Well, I think that'll depend on what happens in Iraq. Many Americans these days kind of fancy themselves experts on Iraq, and I don't. I am afraid that we may not have the wisdom or the knowledge or the cultural understanding to craft a future for that country. But if things turn out better in Iraq over the next weeks and months, certainly he'll be able to take credit for it.
Also, what we heard from the president last night was a bit of a conciliatory tone in part of his speech. Let's listen to this excerpt.
We will continue to listen to honest criticism and make every change that will help us complete the mission. Yet there is a difference between honest critics who recognize what is wrong, and defeatists who refuse to see that anything is right.
Defeatists, what do you think that means, Nolan?
Well, obviously it means the criticism of the war, of going to war, and of the way the war was prosecuted. I think there was one key point the president made in the speech last night, is that, okay, yeah, we didn't find weapons of mass destruction, but we had every reason still to believe they were there, and Saddam Hussein did nothing to change that opinion or to avoid a war. He clearly could have avoided simply by opening up his country to weapons inspectors.
Guy, I'm wondering, do you think that folks outside of the Beltway actually care about this story?
Well, I think they probably care about it, but I think our capacity for outrage on one side or the other is all but exhausted here. Everything is politicized, I think, these days, right up to and including Christmas. And so the people that want to give George W. Bush a break are going to give him a break here, and those that don't aren't going to. And I don't think all these speeches, and they're pretty much the same, he's saying the same things, I don't think they're going to change much. I think really what needs to change is the situation on the ground in Iraq. You know, there was a sad moment last night when he asked us not to despair. But this is a dispiriting mess that he's gotten us into, and it's hard not to despair. We'll try.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Guy McMillan is editorial page editor for the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Nolan Finley is editorial page editor for the Detroit News. Still to come, our jazz man James Isaacs tells us what's on his gift list this holiday season. You're listening to Here and Now. A journalist who spent the past 7 years reporting from China has decided to make an unusual career change. He's joined the U.S. Marines. 31-year-old Matt Pottinger was, until recently, a correspondent in China for the Wall Street Journal. Now, he's a second lieutenant after spending the past 3 months at the Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia. And Matt joins us on the line from his family home in Westchester County in New York. Welcome, Matt, or should I say Lieutenant Pottinger?
Well, for the last 72 hours anyway, I've been a lieutenant. So thanks for having me on the show.
Well, congratulations. But tell us, what prompted you to make this change?
Well, you know, I was working in China for several years for the Wall Street Journal. Terrific life. It was a terrific job. But I, on the one hand, was really distracted by the war in Iraq and the war on terror in general. And that just had the sense that we've got a really tough decade ahead of us, and that at some point I might have a bigger impact actually getting involved rather than just writing about events.
It seems like a very drastic shift, I think. Journalists are required, really, to take an independent view of the institutions they cover, like the military. Do you find that this has been really sort of a 180-degree turn here?
About 180 degrees, you're right. It's a pretty radical shift, I'll give you that.
What about physically also, making the shift from journalist to Marine? You write that you were barely able to run for 5 minutes without getting winded.
It's true. This was the tough part. I gave myself 6 months to try it, and I met a Marine who was studying in Beijing. He ended up coming out with me every morning and running, doing push-ups and pull-ups and hiking on the Great Wall. I'd put on a big backpack and do 12-mile hikes along the Great Wall. And over the course of 6 months, I got to a point where it was a transformation. I was back down to the weight that I was at when I was wrestling in high school. My body adapted.
What do your family and friends say?
My family is very proud of what I'm doing. Everyone's anxious. My mom probably more so than anyone else. But when they came down to the graduation ceremony on Friday, I think it put their mind more at ease because they saw how professional the officers were who trained me and also how professional and terrific the other candidates who graduated with me were.
You know, you're doing this and you became inspired at a time when the Bush administration is facing increasing criticism about its use of the military
sure.
and the war in Iraq. Why do you think that's the case?
You know, it's funny. The decision was really... I can't say it was in a vacuum, but the politics surrounding the war in Iraq were almost irrelevant to the decision. I mean, this is something I began thinking about more than a year ago. It had more to do with a kind of long-term view about where America is and where America is going to be over the next decade. And what role I wanted to play in that myself.
Mm-hmm. You've written about this, and you've said that you're not a quote, rah-rah American. Are there other ways to serve your country maybe that might be less dangerous?
Definitely. And, you know, there are a zillion ways to do it. And the military is the one part of our society that is playing a direct role in participating in trying to make us safer, trying to make us better, and trying to secure our future. We've got real enemies out there.
You say you graduated Friday. What do you do from here?
Well, I get a little bit of time off, and then at the beginning of the year, I go into what's called the basic school. It's 6 months of training. It's going to train me to be an officer and a leader of a platoon of infantrymen before I eventually deploy somewhere. And from there on, we'll see.
It doesn't even sound close to being a journalist.
It's pretty far away.
Yeah.
It's pretty distant, I know.
Well, Matt, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, you're quite welcome.
Second Lieutenant Matt Pottinger left the Wall Street Journal, the paper he'd been reporting for from China, to join the Marines. He wrote about his career change for the newspaper last week. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Cabs and private vans are cruising bus stops in the New York borough of Queens today, looking for passengers who've been stranded by the first phase of what could become a citywide bus and subway strike. The city's transit system, the nation's largest, serves up to 7 million riders every day. The last citywide transit strike was in 1980, and it lasted 11 days. Drivers at two bus lines walked off the job today, but real chaos could occur tomorrow if progress is not made in negotiations with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. A key issue is the minimum age at which an employee can receive a full pension. City officials say if there is a walkout, some cars coming into Manhattan will have to have at least 4 occupants. Well, the holidays are almost here, and if you're still trying to come up with an ideal gift for that jazz or rhythm and blues fan on your list, we have some ideas. Robin Young talked with Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs and asked him for a few recommendations.
James, welcome back and season's greetings.
And to you, Robin.
And we understand you've got some really big ideas for box set gift giving.
Robin, I've got some King Kong-esque ideas for this holiday season's gift giving.
Including a huge box set. Tell us about this.
10 DVDs by the brilliant pianist, composer, I should say keyboardist, composer, Chick Corea. This set is called Rendezvous in New York. It's on the Image Entertainment label.
Well, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
So does he pull it off?
He does, with flying colors. As you know, Robin, and I'm guessing that many of our listeners know this as well, Chick Corea worked with Miles Davis in the late 1960s in the great trumpeter bandleader's early jazz rock fusion bands. Miles was the great white shark of jazz. He was always moving, never sleeping on anything new. And this is a lesson that Chick Corea must have learned from Miles, because on this 10-CD set, we hear Corea leading 9 different ensembles. These range from duets with the vibist Gary Burton and with fellow pianist Gonzalo Rubalcaba and with vocalist Bobby McFerrin. You've also got the Chick Corea acoustic and electric bands, the 3 quartets band featuring Michael Brecker on tenor saxophone, and there are larger groups like the one he calls Remembering Bud Powell, and Korea's most recent groups, Origin and New Trio. One last thing. The 10th DVD is a kind of documentary testimonial, and truth to tell, it's not nearly as compelling as the superb music collected across the other 9 discs.
Well, it just sounds like it's Chick Corea's world, and we just live in it. And it sounds as if, you get every side of Chick Corea.
Exactly. Robin, what I've got for us now is something that Chick Corea calls the Now He Sings, Now He Sobs trio on his piece called Matrix. Chick Corea.
Very powerful piano playing from Chick Corea from his new 10 DVD set. And by the way, we'll have all of James' recommendations on our website, here-now.org. What's next on your holiday list?
Robin, it's another biggie. Mm-hmm. I'd call this the most elaborately packaged box set of the 2005 holiday season, and I'm speaking of Jelly Roll Morton, the Complete Library of Congress Recordings by Alan Lomax on the Rounder Records label. This is an 8-CD set packaged in a box that's made to resemble a grand piano. And the collection also contains not one, but 2 books. The first is an 80-page glossy set of program notes, and the other is an updated edition of the musicologist Alan Lomax's 344-page biography of the ever-insouciant pianist and composer Mr. Jelly Roll, Ferdinand Joseph Lamont, a.k.a. Jelly Roll Morton.
Of course, you got to have these little tinges of Spanish in it. In order to play real good jazz. Jazz has a foundation that must be very prominent, especially with the bass sections, in order to give a great background, plus what's called riffs today, which was known as figures, but figures hasn't always been in the dance bands. I'll give you an idea what the idea of Spanish there is in the blues. Particular tune, I wouldn't be honest if I said that maybe the whole tune belonged to me, although my name is on it. It's supposed to be arranged by Mr. Joe Jordan, but these arrangements were made also by myself.
Robin, one last thing. I should point out that disc number 8 is comprised of some of Jelly Roll Morton's illustrious friends and colleagues telling stories about him and about playing New Orleans music. These were recorded in 1949, and they are a wonderful way to conclude this essential collection of Jelly Roll Morton's music and memories.
Okay, next on your list, James, is something that would be a wonderful gift suggestion for people in a certain part of the country to place under their tree, although some of them won't have trees and
yeah,
no
that's
homes.
True. Yeah, right.
Tell us about this.
Well, I'll tell you, this would be a great gift for anyone in any part of the country because it's New Orleans music in all of its glory. This is the perfect introduction to the many flavors of the Crescent City's musical gumbo. It's a 4-CD boxed set from the Shout Factory reissue label, and it's called, ready for this? Doctors, Professors, Kings and Queens, The Big Old Box of New Orleans, a rhyming couplet for the title.
It contains, 85 cuts?
85 prime cuts by 83 artists. You name them, and the chances are good that they're in here. Jazz, blues, R&B, soul music, funk, Zydeco, even the modern jam band Galactic, they're all here.
So I want to hear some of this.
What I've come up with is the seminal pianist, vocalist, and composer Henry Roland Byrd, better known as Professor Longhair. And they called him Fess down in New Orleans. And this is one of New Orleans' great favorite tunes, Tippity.
I'll say, hurry, hurry, come on, operator. Girl, you have company waiting for you at home. Why don't you hurry, operator, girl, hurry. Don't leave that boy alone.
Cut off the new 4-CD box set, Doctors, Professors, Kings and Queens, The Big Old Box of New Orleans. I just love the title.
Great title.
And James, you have suggested these lavish, these huge box sets, but is there anything for the, you know, maybe the more budget-minded?
Robin, I do have just the thing, but the recipient of the 2-disc set that I have in mind had better be prepared to have his or her skull blown apart by the most powerful saxophone sound ever heard. I'm speaking, of course, of John Coltrane's tenor saxophone at its absolute peak in the mid-1960s. The album is called One Down, One Up. It was recorded live at the Half Note in New York in the spring of 65, which was a homey place, really an Italian restaurant, a little place on New York's Lower West Side. And during that time, Coltrane's great quartet did 2 live radio broadcasts. The tapes of these broadcasts have been circulating for years on the bootleg circuit, but now, thanks to John Coltrane's saxophone-playing son, Ravi, they are commercially available for the first time. And what a find, especially the title track, 27-plus minutes of Coltrane's tenor with the volcanic drummer Elvin Jones lifting him higher and higher and higher and higher.
Coltrane playing in 1965 on just one of the CDs recommended by our own James Isaacs, jazz aficionado and personal shopper. If you're having any trouble with last-minute ideas, go to our website, here-now.org. We'll have all of his recommendations. James, thanks so much.
Robin, as always, a pleasure, especially at holiday time.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.